Welcome in to another episode of the Baseball America College Baseball Podcast. My name is Jacob Rudner. I'm joined, as always, by my co-host, Mr. Peter Flaherty. And Peter, as always, a reminder for the people. We are through 7 weeks now of the college baseball season. We've had some big movement in the poll, not necessarily at the top, which we'll get into. We've had some big movement in the middle. And there's a whole lot of exciting stuff going on across the college baseball landscape right now. We're going to talk about a whole bunch of it. Before we do, though, as always, tell the good people how you're doing.
I've given the same response now, I think, in each of the 8 weeks, but it's hard to not be doing excellent with all the action that's going on around the country. We finally had kind of this big time. It was like moving week, I guess you could call it, in the top 25. I guess in the lead up to this week, it was sort of, you know, there wasn't any dramatic shifts. I'd say we had a handful of teams enter at the back end of the top 25, but relatively speaking, it remained the same through the top 20 or so outside of some shuffling. But this week we finally got some chaos, which made for a fun top 25 call on Sunday. It also made for some fun now storylines heading into this weekend and the rest of the season. So we're flooring it in the second half of the spring.
No, we really are. And I think it's interesting that you pointed out the amount of movement that we had in our most recent poll, because it is the most movement that we've had so far. And especially at the middle of the pack, we typically have some movement towards the back end of the top 25, where we'll introduce, you know, typically between one and maybe three in a big week teams on the list, especially as we get deeper into the season. This week we had two newcomers, but a lot of teams in new spots. Oregon was 11 last week and now number 21 in the poll. UC Irvine jumped from 17 to 13. North Carolina from 18 to 11. We're going to talk about the Tar Heels on this episode. UCLA from number 25 to number 17. And then two newcomers, like I said, Virginia Tech jumped in at number 25 and Kansas at number 23. So this was kind of the most action-packed week, if you will, of the season to date.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think, and also at the back end of the top 25, not to play our hand a little bit, we debated a handful of more teams in addition to those that joined it. So, I mean, you're looking at now like 30 to 31 plus teams or so that have legitimate top 25 cases. So, you know, every weekend series from here on out is, it just gets more and more pivotal. Obviously, from a ranking standpoint, that's all well and good, but you know, for better or worse, that's kind of like, I don't want to say a fake badge, but I mean, also from a tournament standpoint, you know, improving one's RPI, improving one's resume, conference record, you know, every game, every series will just mean more and more going forward.
No doubt. Let's talk about some teams specifically who have been able to kind of capitalize on what it is that you just talked about. And none in my mind at this moment stand out more to me than Wes Johnson's Georgia team. They're 28-2 overall. They're 8-1 against top 25 competition. This is a phenomenal group, and they're doing it in a way that I don't know we really expected. I think before the season, when you and I were talking about Georgia, one of the things that we discussed rather frequently was this was going to be a team that, maybe unlike last year, was going to be a lot stronger on the mound. They brought in some new pieces who have really shiny stuff, was kind of how we put it before the season started. And Wes Johnson has a history, of course, of working with pitchers at the professional level. But the reality has been that this is a phenomenal hitting team that scores almost more runs than any other team in the country. And their pitching still has some elements to kind of figure out as they go here. But nonetheless, they're 28-2 overall through 30 games. Wes Johnson is closing in on the best record in a two-year stretch for a Georgia coach. What do you think?
I mean, it's hard to not be ultra impressed with what the Bulldogs are doing. And I'd say in a handful of other years, you know, they'd probably be the number one team in the country if it wasn't for a Tennessee team that is looking like it might be historically good, an Arkansas team that was off to an historical start through 25 games, and they've kept up their pace, most notably sweeping Vanderbilt this past weekend. So Georgia sitting there at 28-2 and number four in the country, it's pretty remarkable. You know, and you've got some great nuggets on Coach Johnson, who's done an outstanding job. But the offense is one of the more impressive groups in college baseball, and it's an older, experienced unit, really outside of Trey Phelps, who's a draft eligible sophomore. But they rank 23rd nationally, I believe, in team batting average. Ryland Zaborowski and Robbie Burnett, two grad transfers they got from the portal, rank second and third respectively nationally when it comes to, you know, individual home run totals. And then RBIs wise, I believe Ryland's 48 ranks are tied for second nationally, behind just Justin LeBron, who's the star sophomore at Alabama. So, I mean, they simply put, they mash. I mean, they can really drive the baseball. They're consistently on the barrel. The offensive environment they play in at Foley Field, I think, is really conducive to their success. And up until last weekend against Auburn, who was previously inside the top 15, they hadn't necessarily had the toughest schedule or the biggest tests. They had swept a struggling Florida team down in Gainesville in emphatic fashion, which was impressive, even regardless of Florida's struggles. But last weekend was very, very impressive from the Bulldogs, and it doesn't get any easier. This weekend they go to Austin to take on Texas in a top five matchup, a matchup that if they win, they will at least go to number three in next week's poll, if not higher. So, I mean, that'll be another good barometer for them. And they're kind of entering a four-week gauntlet here in the month of April with Texas, Arkansas, Vanderbilt, and Oklahoma on the schedule. So a tough month lies ahead, but this team is for real, I think.
No, I think it's very fair to say at this point that Georgia is for real. We are, believe it or not, closing in on, if not past for some teams, the halfway point in the regular season. So at this point, we know who teams are. It's no secret that this Georgia team is really good. I want to zero in for a second, and I know this is not the draft podcast, which I highly encourage everybody to listen to. Peter does a great job on that as well. But I want to talk about Ryland Zaborowski for just a second. Transfer from Miami, Ohio. He's a senior. He plays corner infield, also a DH for Georgia. Peter, I think we're at the point right now with Zaborowski that he might be in the player of the year conversation. I mean, he's batting over 400, well over 442. You mentioned the stat about his home runs. He is kind of doing everything for this team, and we're at a point in the season, like I said a second ago, where I don't really view individual performances at this moment as fluky. I mean, this is what guys are, and he's doing it. So what are your thoughts on just where he's starting to stack up nationally? And, you know, to separate from the draft conversation, let's not talk about him as a pro prospect here. Let's talk about him as a relevant national college baseball player and where he stacks up on that scene.
Yeah, I mean, I think when you look at the National Player of the Year conversation and certainly the SEC Player of the Year conversation, it's really just based on, for better or worse, the back of the baseball card. So, I mean, his 442 average ranks 16th nationally. He's top three nationally in both home runs and RBIs. He's the only player in the country, obviously, that fits inside that criteria. So, I mean, just from a, like you said, like an individual award standpoint, you know, who he is as a player and how productive he's been this year, he's certainly in the running for a lot of major awards. And I mean, he's got plus power that he's had no issue tapping to in game. He's made some slight adjustments to his setup and operation since transferring into Georgia that's allowed him to tap into that. The swing decisions are polished. I mean, the plate coverage with power, just given how big of a kid he is, has been really impressive. So he's had about as good of a season as I think, you know, anyone would want. So he's right there when it comes to SEC Player of the Year, Golden Spikes, everything. I mean, he's squarely in the mix.
Interestingly, I mean, like you said, this is a big guy with obviously big power, 14 home runs on the year among the top 20 guys in that category, 20 to 17 walks to strikeouts. He's walking more than he is striking out. And so the profile is starting to become very interesting on him. One other guy on Georgia, before we move on to some other topics here, Robbie Burnett, to me, is also in that conversation. He's hitting 363 with 13 home runs. So he's right on Ryland's tail, 868 slugging. He is also in that really, you know, shiny strikeout to walk ratio. He's got 27 walks and just 20 strikeouts. getting on base at a 570 clip right now. Another guy who to me is in that Golden Spikes SEC Player of the Year category. And also point out, you know, another sign of the masterful recruiting in the transfer portal that Wes Johnson and his staff have been able to put together.
Yeah, unfortunately for Robbie, when it comes to the individual awards, he's kind of chasing teammate Ryland there. But again, he's just looking at his numbers and what he's done so far. He's hitting 363. You mentioned 13 home runs, 41 RBIs. I mean, that's, you know, all conference type deal. Another guy that doesn't chase. He doesn't expand the strike zone at all. He's got a knack for moving the baseball. And he's also tapped into, you know, more of his raw power since arriving on campus in Athens. And I'm just going to pull it up quick. As far as individual season home run totals go, you know, he's an older, experienced guy. He's going to be he's 22 now. He hit 18 last year at UNC Asheville. He's on pace to, I wouldn't say smash that, but he's on pace for 20, 22 plus homers, which would obviously be a career high. Last year, he set a previous career high with 45 RBIs. He's already got 41. That could be broken by the end of Georgia's midweek game, theoretically, tonight. So career year for Burnett, career year for Zaborowski, and is circling back to your point, just excellent recruiting in the transfer portal by Coach Johnson, because you know, these have been excellent finds.
Let's turn our focus here. We've talked a lot about Georgia, and rightfully so, a really good team. One interesting team to me that moved up in the poll, but I know you and I have had some conversations about what exactly they are, is North Carolina. Last week, they went 3-1. They broke a spell of non-winning weeks, not losing weeks. They went 2-2 three straight times, and then went 3-1 last week with wins over South Carolina and then 2-3 against Miami over the weekend. They're 21-7 overall, 1-2 against top 25 competition, and they're 5-2 on weekend series. And yet, they've moved up to 11 at last week. And we talked about it at the open of the podcast. There was a lot of movement in the middle of the poll. Some teams had rough weeks last week, and just poll dynamics kind of vaulted North Carolina from 18 to 11. I think in a more normal, stabilized week where we don't have that much movement from the middle chunk of the poll, I think you and I would agree that they probably would have gone more from like 18 to 14 probably. So just kind of a weird deal there. But what is this North Carolina team to you? What do you make of this group? To me, and you can correct me if you think I'm wrong, I see a team that has a lot of talent, but hasn't necessarily tapped into it all the way, especially so at the plate, where I think there's kind of a lot more to give.
Yeah, I know you and I and a lot of others were really high on them, both coming into the season, and then they started 13-0. And made a whole lot of noise early on, and then they kind of stumbled once ACC play began. They lost two straight series to Stanford and Louisville, and then have since bounced back against lesser opponents in Boston College and Miami. It's kind of crazy to talk about Miami in a similar breath as Boston College, and that's no offense to either program, but it's just, you know, Miami is, yeah, that's a whole other can of worms. But yeah, UNC, the area in which I'm a little concerned with the Tar Heels is offensively. I think as a team, and I have to get the exact numbers, they're hitting a rather modest, I think in the 260, 275-ish range. Their pitching staff, I think, if you want a silver lining for a team, obviously scoring and producing runs and being able to out hit teams is really important. But I think when focusing on longevity and how far I think you can make a run come June, you obviously want to have pitching depth. Like, there's only so much you can do if you run out of pitching. Like, I mean, and they can pitch with anyone, especially in the rotation. You look at Jake Knapp, Aiden Hawk, and star sophomore Jason DeCaro. And performance wise, DeCaro's actually been number three of three and guys in that rotation, which speaks volumes. And then the depth doesn't stop there. Ryan Lynch and Walker McDuffie, the dynamic freshman duo, have been excellent in relief. Matthew Mathias, they've trotted out there, I think, 16 times. So they can really, really pitch it. I am a tad worried though about the lineup and just like how productive a unit it's going to be going forward. So, I mean, that's certainly something to watch for. But back to your point on poll dynamics, like you said, like they wouldn't have moved up very much if teams in front of it had taken care of business. Like, it's nice to go 3-1. They had a nice neutral site win over South Carolina and then a solid series win over Miami. But five teams ahead of it lost, three or four got swept. So, I mean, there was really no choice but to move them up. So they were kind of the beneficiaries of, you know, Vanderbilt getting swept, who was a team that was right in front of them, Wake getting swept, Auburn getting swept, and then Oregon losing a tough series. So it was certainly an interesting week from that standpoint.
Yeah, I mean, I also would think it's important to point out here, I think that this is a North Carolina team that has the potential to do a lot of damage later. And granted, you know, right now it might not look that way if you look over the stats, some of which you just mentioned. But the other thing is, what was important and you led with this, was we did really think very highly of this team going into the season. And I probably wouldn't have predicted that they'd be hitting 269 as a group with 30 home runs, you know, halfway through the season, or pitching with, you know, the way that they have, I think has exceeded expectations. I think if those two performances kind of marry a little bit somewhere in the middle, you know, the pitching continues to be stable, not necessarily this all-star level that it has been. I don't know that you can expect that. And the hitting starts to perform a little bit more like we expected in a positive way. This is a team that has the potential to get back to Omaha and do damage there as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think also the offense as a whole is a lot, I wouldn't say necessarily a lot better than what they're doing as a team right now, but they're certainly better than the numbers. Like, I think it's only a matter of time before, especially that duo of Luke Stevenson and Kane Kepley, get going. I think sophomore Gavin Gallagher, who's kind of been hot and cold, will find this happy medium and be more of a steady producer for them. So that's three guys who I envision producing more than they have been now, which will help the unit as a whole hit its stride. But, you know, again, obviously projecting and assuming a little bit, which is dangerous to do in baseball and just in anything in general. So their offense is certainly something to watch going forward. And I think barring something drastic changing, it's going to be something that we talk about come tournament time, is like, hey, you know, UNC is, I mean, they're certainly in the hosting mix. So, I mean, if they end up hosting, it's like, you know, they could be a number one seed that's potentially on the ropes of an early exit, just given its inability to hit. But I think that's going way, way ahead of ourselves. There's still talent in that unit. They can really, really pitch. As we said, I have the utmost confidence in that pitching staff, and I think the pitching staff alone gives them the upside to play well into June.
Well, to like, not necessarily to draw a direct comparison here, but to liken them to a team that has existed in the past, think about Arkansas last year. I mean, this is an Arkansas team that had all the pitching talent in the world, led by Hagen Smith, who was arguably the best pitcher in the game. And you have a lineup that was not performing nearly well enough to be able to support that. And they made a very early exit and probably didn't deliver upon the potential that a lot of people had for them. I think the biggest difference, however, between that Arkansas team and this North Carolina one is that I see a lot more guys in North Carolina's lineup who I think are going to be able to step up and do a lot more damage than I think Arkansas went into the postseason with last year. I mean, you look up and down the order here, Luke Stevenson, who we talk about a great deal on this podcast, is a fantastic hitter. Tyson Bass has been very good. I think he can continue to play that way. You mentioned Kane Kepley. He's been hitting only 267. And I think that could go and rise up quite a bit, especially just with his maturity and baseball IQ and vision for the plate and the zone. So I think that, you know, the big difference here, if you're going to think positive for North Carolina, is they have a lot of guys who have the potential to help them break out of this at some point.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not going to be sitting there as an opposing pitcher and see Luke Stevenson or Kane Kepley in the batter's box and breathe a sigh of relief and think I can kind of take an at bat off. Like, those two guys are legit dudes. So I think it's a when and not an if that they kind of get going. Like, Kepley had gotten off to a really strong start. And then recently he's just kind of cooled off. Stevenson was a little bit more up and down. He started to kind of hit his stride a little bit. It can't be overstated how valuable he is behind the plate, but I mean, I think once they kind of you know, get in this flow state, so to speak, the offense will be fine. But it's certainly something to watch because, I mean, they haven't been scoring at all really recently. They scored 13 in a midweek against South Carolina, but, I mean, midweeks are midweeks. So, I mean, before that, they've scored double-digit runs, I think, just once since March 8th, which is almost a month's worth of games. So definitely something to keep an eye on.
Yeah, very high-stakes week this week, too, for North Carolina as far as where it's going to be in the poll moving forward. They have Gardner-Webb tonight being April 1st when we're recording this, and then weekend series against a Duke team that started the season out in the top 25, fell out after a pretty rough stretch, and is now, I would go as far as to say, probably team number 26 in the next one knocking on the door to enter the top 25 again. So North Carolina has to handle business. All those games, by the way, are at home. So you would think that this is an opportunity to maybe make a statement after a couple of lackluster weeks, especially like we said on that offensive side. Let's talk about a team that is also in kind of an interesting situation, but for entirely different reasons. Texas right now is, in my opinion, one of the best teams in the country. And you and I have said that on the podcast. We're on the record with that multiple times. We've written it. The biggest thing for Texas, however, is that it's dealing with some pretty significant injuries. Right fielder Max Ballou, who had been their best hitter by far so far this season, is in a position now where he may miss the rest of the regular season, if not slightly longer. He had to undergo a thumb surgery on his left thumb after suffering an injury against Missouri. Star freshman third baseman Adrian Rodriguez, they got some reasonably good news there, is day-to-day with an upper body injury. I think it was feared that that was going to be a lot worse. And then starting catcher Ryland Galvin, who's been outstanding for Texas so far this season, has really emerged. He too has a finger injury that has made him day-to-day. So a couple guys who are out for a short term, Blue obviously being the big one, potentially out for the rest of the season. I'm curious what this does to our opinions on Texas. You know, for you, and I'll point out, if you head on over to baseballamerica.com/college, where you can see all of our college content, I just put up an SEC power ranking this morning on April 1st. And I had Texas, much to the chagrin of their fan base, up down to number 5. We have them ranked 3rd in the top 25. The reason being entirely, it remains to be seen what's going to happen with these injuries. What do you think?
Yeah, I think so. Texas can really, really pitch it. It's no secret. The addition of Coach Wiener, really the addition of that entire coaching staff from Coach Schlossnagel on down. But Coach Wiener especially has been always regarded as one of, if not the best pitching coaches in college baseball. And that's shown from the get-go. I mean, Texas is 3.22 team ERA, ranks 3rd nationally. There really isn't a dud on that entire pitching staff. Everyone more or less has been outstanding outside of a handful of bad appearances. But I think anyone they trot out there, they can feel really confident in. But lineup-wise, losing a guy like Ballou, who's a potential late first round, early second round type of draft pick, that's going to really hurt. And it's going to potentially hurt more on an offensive unit that I'd say more reliable on guys like Ballou and sort of their bigger producers. They haven't necessarily as a unit, been unbelievably, I'd say, like, I'm trying to phrase this correctly. They don't have like a met. It's certainly a team that's built on its pitching. So, I mean, the loss of Ballou, I think, is going to certainly be felt. But what I keep circling back to is that Mississippi State series, which I believe was its first SEC series on the road. And I think the duo of Ballou and Jalen Flores went a combined 1-for-20. And they still were able to pull off a sweep of a good Mississippi State team and on the road at that. So, I mean, you know, I don't know if you can mention like Mississippi State and Georgia really in the same breath, but I think that it goes to show that guys are willing to rise to the occasion and are kind of hungry to rise to the occasion and step up when their stars aren't producing or their stars aren't, you know, healthy or going good. So I'm kind of excited almost to see who emerges here, I guess, not necessarily out of the woodwork, but and tries to kind of take the reins of the offense. Will Gasparino had an excellent week last weekend. I think he hit 5 home runs. Adrian Rodriguez and Ryland Galvin being both day-to-day is huge. If those guys were out for an extended period of time, I'd still tout like Texas's depth guys as willing participants to step up, but that creates just like a gaping hole that's almost irreplaceable. So I think it'll be kind of a, and you alluded to this on your story, which was a very insightful one. I think it'll be kind of a committee as to who steps up and tries to replace, I guess, the irreplaceable in Max Blue. It'll sort of be a, you know, combo of Easton Winfield, Jaden Duplantier, Tommy Farmer has gotten some run recently and has kind of made his way into the starting nine. So, you know, expect to not necessarily see a revolving door, but a handful of names out there in the outfield. But I think just with how well Texas has been pitching it, it's hard to not feel confident in them at least being in every game going forward. I mean, this series against Georgia is going to be a dandy, but and they'll have their hands full with Georgia's lineup. But I still feel this doesn't really change how I feel at all about Texas, especially if he's able to come back either at the end of the regular season or as postseason play ramps up.
You know, I think it's interesting specifically for this weekend, to your point. You're facing a team like Georgia that we, like we talked about, can score with anybody. How does the Texas offense fare in an environment that, even with a good pitching staff in my mind, is going to be pretty high in the run count? I think that Texas is going to have to keep up this weekend in that big series top five matchup. Will they be able to do it? Maybe. It's going to require a pretty big performance from somebody else. You mentioned Will Gasparino's coming off a huge week. Jalen Flores is going well, hitting .307 with seven homers, 26 RBIs this season. Could he be somebody who steps up, you know, in an even bigger way and maybe even has a performance that's more in line with what he was able to do last year as a sophomore that helps them out? But the big thing is that you're going to have to score a whole bunch in order to keep up with this Bulldog team. And I will be curious to see exactly what that looks like with Texas now that their biggest producer is not going to be available, and potentially others. Like we mentioned, Adrian Rodriguez, we don't know if he's going to play this weekend. Same with Galvan. But if they do, obviously that becomes an even more interesting series than it already is. Let's talk about another team here, Peter, that is dealing with the injury bug, maybe more than any other in the country, at least among the top teams. That's Florida. Florida was our number 7 team in the preseason poll, and they have steadily dropped ever since then. This week, for the first time, there is no Gator presence in the top 25. This is a really struggling group. They're 1-8 against conference foes. Their record is still comfortably above 500, but that is a largely non-con byproduct, and they're missing a whole bunch of guys. Pierce Capalla is still out. He has not yet started throwing, according to a source. Frank Menendez, their top left-handed reliever, is out due to Tommy John surgery. Kyle Jones, the starting center fielder, who you and I like a good bit, he is out for the rest of the season with a torn labrum. Cade Kurland is dealing with some, you know, lingering shoulder soreness from an injury that occurred against Miami a couple weeks ago when his shoulder seemingly popped out, and he's been in and out of the lineup. Liam Peterson missed a week with some arm soreness himself. He's back in the rotation, but that's always a scary thing when your top guy's dealing with a, I don't want to call it an arm issue, but, you know, an arm ailment. And this is a Florida team that is running out of time to rebound. And they've never missed the postseason under head coach Kevin O'Sullivan, who took over in 2008. And right now, if we're being frank, Peter, they seemingly are in a spot where that's where they're headed. They're going to miss the tournament this year.
Yeah, it's kind of been a tale of two seasons for Florida. They started off 11-0, and then they were 16-2. And then they were 16-2 coming off a really, really strong midweek win at rival Florida State. And then I guess since then, it's just been downhill since. They're, I believe it's 3-8. They got swept at Tennessee. They got swept against Georgia. They lost a key series this weekend at Ole Miss, which felt like not a get-right opportunity because Ole Miss is a high-quality club, but a really, I'd say, golden opportunity to go and try and right the ship a little bit. And I think a lot of its struggles, Florida's struggles, are to an extent, I guess, out of its control, just given what, like, I mean, the injuries that you said, I mean, these are not insignificant at all. It's been to guys like Pierce Capalla, who was excellent through three starts. Frank Menendez profiled as a key bullpen arm and had already turned in a handful of excellent appearances. Losing Liam Peterson for a start is massive. Injuries to the offense with Kyle Jones, who is a potential day one draft prospect in 2026, Cade Kierland. It just hasn't stopped for Florida. And I mean, there's only so much you can do. And they've had to, you know, rework their starting nine, rework their pitching staff, and kind of try and recomplete the puzzle that they were able to do so over the off season. So it's no easy task for the coaching staff. The players got to adjust on the fly. Like, the talent is still there, but like you said, that 1-8 start in SEC play, there are certainly easier things to overcome. But, you know, and just looking at the next few series, they host Vanderbilt, and then they've got Missouri and Mississippi State in consecutive weekends. It kind of feels like, I don't want to call this weekend a must-win series. I don't know if we're in that territory yet, but it kind of feels like they got to take at least two of these next three series to sort of try and rebound here a little bit as the end of the season is only getting closer.
One thing I think is going to be really interesting with this Florida club, let me back up here for a second. The generally accepted number for an at-large bid out of the SEC and conference wins is 13. Florida obviously has won. There are 21 games left, so they have to go 12-9 the rest of the way in order to be able to accomplish the record that you need at a minimum just to be in the consideration bucket to get into the NCAA tournament. I do have questions at this point about whether or not Florida is going to be able to do that. And you look at the guys who are hurt, and that's going to be where the challenge lies. Aiden King is a true freshman. He's in their weekend rotation. It seems like even with the healthy guys that they do have, and we didn't talk about this a second ago, there are even some questions there. This past weekend, Jake Clemente was in more of a reliever role. Alex Philpott seemingly has gone from closer to a potential starting option for them. Billy Barlow, the Clemson transfer, has been tried out over the weekends and it hasn't gone great. So not only is this a Florida team that has some pretty significant injuries, it's a group that's kind of looking for answers with the guys it still has healthy. That's also the case at the plate, where they have a couple guys going through some struggles right now. You know, this is a team that is going to need to figure out things with the healthy guys it has, and also hope that some of these injured players are going to get healthy in time to make some contributions. And we're not talking about in a couple weeks. I mean, it's now it's crunch time. Florida has to win if it wants to keep its postseason streak alive.
Yeah. I mean, we're now in April, which for some teams, as you pointed out, I think can be viewed as crunch time, and trying to find answers on the fly at this point in the season. I mean, there are a lot more easy things to be done than that. So I guess trying to like plug and play guys and trying to figure out their newfound roles and where they fit best is certainly a difficult task. And you hit on it with trying to trot out Jake Clemente in relief and see if you can get a little bit of, I guess, reliance there. So I mean, like you said, they got to start stacking wins and start stacking them quick.
Let's talk about some teams here that are stacking wins. We've had some back-to-back doom and gloom segments with Texas's injuries and Florida's injuries. Let's talk about some top 25 newcomers, Peter. Virginia Tech and Kansas made their top 25 debuts this past week. Virginia Tech was outstanding last week. They went to Wake Forest and earned a huge sweep over the Demon Deacons, a team that we like a lot. And they did it in pretty emphatic fashion. 13-2 run rule victory over Wake Forest on Friday night, 11-8 win on Saturday, and they closed things out with a very tightly contested 6-5 victory on Sunday. They've got a lot of talent. This is an offense that is potent. Talk to me about the Hokies.
Yeah, I mean, they broke out in a big way last weekend, obviously, with its road sweep of Wake Forest. But, I mean, they've been performing, I'd say, at a pretty solid clip for most, if not all, of the season, especially recently. They also, in the lead up to the sweep of Wake Forest, they also took 2 of 3 from a Louisville team that we view in a really positive light, and a high quality Louisville team at that. But offensively, the offense has been led by a breakout season from senior outfielder Sam Tackett. Tackett's always had plus raw power, but he's making contact at a more consistent basis this spring, which has allowed him to tap into his raw power in game for the first time in his career. He's also made some positive adjustments to his operation. He's wider in his base. He's sitting deeper in his stance. He's got 10 home runs and 32 RBIs Both are already career highs, and he's hitting over 400. And then outside of Tackett, it's been just this steady string of producers, no matter where you look. David McCann, Henry Cook, transfer infielder Jared Davis, who was an excellent get out of the transfer portal. Offensively, it's just a real steady, reliable group. And even freshman Hudson Luterman he can really, really hit. I mean, I don't know. Like, I think this statistically he'll look really positive at the end of the season. He's only got, I think, 39 at bats up to this point, but he can really, really swing it. Like, in looking at kind of, you know, Virginia Tech's track record of producing legit bats, Luterman is next in line. Like, he rakes, simply put. And then on the mound, I think that that's where they really, really shine. And it's led by freshman right-hander sophomore right-hander Brett Renfro, had an excellent freshman season, enjoying similar success as a sophomore, 37 strikeouts in as many innings pitched with a 2.1 ERA. And then there's just a bevy of reliable bullpen arms. Really anywhere you look on that pitching staff, you can feel confident in them giving you, I'd say, a solid appearance. And I think the unsung hero there, and I'm probably a prisoner of the moment, is Grant Manning, a veteran right-hander. And you look at his numbers to this point, he's got an ERA north of 8, but he threw 4 1/3 key innings this past weekend. I believe it was in their middle game, the middle win over Wake Forest. I think he allowed just one run across 4 1/3. He's been excellent. So it's just a really, I'd say, solid and steady group on both sides of the baseball.
You talk about performers. You mentioned Sam Tackett, Jared Davis, also somebody who's been outstanding. 333 average, 6 homers, 28 RBIs, and 13 stolen bases, which is a team high in 17 attempts. So they got guys who can kind of do it all for them. You mentioned some of the pitchers who have performed well. You look across the field, their offensive players bring different skill sets to the table, and they're all kind of playing really well in their roles. They have 4 different guys who are regulars, hitting over 300 still halfway through the season. So this is an impressive group, and I think that we were excited to be able to bring them into the rankings at 20-8 overall and 5-1 against top 25 competition. For us, you've done enough to prove that you belong in the rankings, and I actually would go as far as to predict that this could be a Virginia Tech team that's here to stay in our top 25 for a little while longer.
Yeah, I'm with you. I think from a longevity standpoint, they also check that box, just given their depth again on either side of the baseball. And you know, I really like how they play. They've been a consistent contender now in the ACC. So come tournament time, I really don't think that's going to be a 2 seed that anyone wants to see.
Let's jump over to our other top 25 newcomer. This is another team that, you know, I'm very high on, and that's Kansas. In at number 23 right now, they're 22-6 overall, 6-1 over the weekends. They're one of the top scoring offenses in the country so far this season. They've pitched well. Dominic Vaguely, their Friday night guy, a sophomore right-hander, has performed excellently. Just to give you the number exactly on that, on the scoring, 9.4 runs per game from Kansas. They rank 11th. And the thing, by the way, that stands out to me, not to dump too much on the people here about Kansas, but I love the way Kansas recruits. It's very different than what we see in today's day and age. This is not a team that is, spoiled with lots of NIL money as some of its competition might be. And so they needed to find other ways to be successful on the recruiting front. And the way that Coach Dan Fitzgerald has gone about it is by attacking the JUCO level. They do an excellent job of filling out their roster with JUCO experienced players. Not a whole lot of freshmen on this team, so it's a very mature, older group. And they have all the right tools to be successful in college baseball. So it looks a little bit different. As you've put it before, they zag where others kind of zig. And this is a good group. I mean, kind of like Virginia Tech, probably here to stay for a little while longer in the top 25.
I'm with you, and I'm happy you brought up the coaching staff's recruiting strategy a little bit in the transfer portal. And I think that there is something to be said for having an older, experienced group. I think when the lights get bright, it's real easy to let the nerves get the best of you. The game will speed up. you make unforced errors. And when you get an older group like that, even if they aren't necessarily kids who are coming from teams that played in a regional, a super regional, Omaha, just the mental maturity and the ability to handle kind of these high pressure situations, you know, I think that's such an invaluable trait, and you get it obviously more with older kids than you do younger. It's just a natural progression of, I guess, life, you could say. But they attack the junior college ranks. They do an excellent job of it. Brady Ballinger in particular has been, I mean, he's not only one of the best hitters in the Big 12, he's been one of the better hitters in America up to this point. I mean, he's hitting over 400 with 8 doubles, 9 home runs. He's got twice as many walks as he does strikeouts, with a walk to strikeout ratio of 36 to 18. Like, he's a Team USA type of guy this summer, and a potential top 5 round, 3-5 round draft prospect come 2026. And he came from College of Southern Nevada, and he's been excellent. And that's not even to mention a number of other guys who've been key producers. Like Tommy Barth was a dynamo at East Tennessee State, kind of a scrappy top of the order type of guy. He's been excellent to this point, hitting over 300. Dariel Osorio has been one of their key producers. Jackson Hogue, as well, as 36 RBIs and 12 home runs each total, leads the team. And then on the mound, Dominic Vegley's kind of their dude and biggest draft prospect. He was excellent this past weekend. And then even outside of Vegley, their arms both in the rotation and in the bullpen who have thrown the ball really, really well. I think looking mostly at Cooper Moore, a fellow sophomore starter who's been excellent, and then Cannon Carr, who they've used in both relief and then also as a starter. So, like, I'm with you that they have the talent to stick in the rankings. The Big 12, as is the case really every year, no matter who the members of the conference are, like, it's chaos. Really, every team is kind of solid. Anyone can beat anyone. So it's not like they've got a rest in their schedule coming up with consecutive road series at Central Florida and TCU. But I mean, I feel it's hard to not feel confident in the Jayhawks going into those two series.
No, I completely agree. And like I said, just to kind of circle back to this, the recruiting element of what Kansas is doing is easily, and you can talk about the stats all you want, but it's easily the most impressive thing to me, just when you look at this group. I mean, we're talking about a team that is built unlike really anything that's been successful in the last few years in college baseball. You could go and look at Kentucky maybe from last year and say this is kind of similar, just with the way that they recruit not just the Division I transfer portal, but also the Division II and Division III transfer portal, and they find some gems out of that group. And there are obviously a couple JUCO guys over there. So that's probably the most similar. But the amount of JUCO players on this Kansas team exceeds any other in the country. I believe off the top of my head, there are 17 former JUCO newcomers on that roster this year. It's the most in the country by a ton. I think they're the only Division I Power 4 team with double-digit JUCO newcomers on their roster. And like we said, they're very successful doing it. The other thing that I'll add, Peter, before I toss it back to you for a final thought here on Kansas, it is pronounced Haugie, Jackson Haugie. I should have told you that before we recorded, but it is Haugie.
I got to lock in. I got to be better. You did tip me off, though, I will say. You tipped me off pre-recording to Dominic Vegley's, the pronunciation of Vegley, which is much appreciated, because I don't think I would have gotten Vegley on attempt number one here.
It's okay. We've earned the business of mispronunciation to some degree. Let's move on to the real winner here, Peter, to the section that you liked the most. Let's talk picks to click. Boy. For those of you who are new to the podcast here, this is a game I dominate and Peter's trying to figure out. It's called Picks to Click. Basically, it's pretty simple. We each pick one player per week. We alternate between hitting and pitching, and whoever puts together the best performance gets one of us a point based on whoever picked that player. We have some interesting circumstances, though, right now with Picks to Click. First of all, I lead 4-1. We've only been able to score 5 weeks, and we're through 7. So you might be wondering, what has occurred? Well, 2 weeks ago, Peter made a selection on the pitching side who didn't end up playing, Sean Episcope from Princeton. He had got scratched from his start. Last week, we decided to redo the pitching, and we both went with relievers. I went with UC Irvine lefty Ricky Ojeda. You picked UC Santa Barbara lefty Cole Triba. Neither of them, despite being each of their own respective team's star relievers, played in a game. So we have back-to-back no-contest weeks. This week, to try and make up for it, Peter, we're going to pick two players each, one hitter, and then we're both going to redo our two relievers from last week. So you have a potential to make up some ground here. It could go from 4-1 to 4-3. Give me your hitter, and then maybe talk a little bit quickly about Cole Triba one more time, just so people remember who you got on your team.
Yeah, absolutely. I'll start with my hitter. So I'm going to go with Coastal Carolina catcher Caden Bodine. Having a solid season up to this point, hitting over 320 with seven extra base hits, including three home runs. Has been on a little bit of a quieter stretch over his last five games. I think he's just 4-18. I've got him pegged for a breakout weekend. In this weekend series, has some of the best contact skills of any draft prospect in this year's class, sporting an 89% overall contact rate and a 97% in-zone contact rate. He swung and missed at just three pitches in the strike zone. Really advanced feel for the barrel, comfortably plus hitter, and he's got an advanced defensive skill set as well, behind the plate, where he's an above-average defender. Not that the defense matters from a picks-to-click standpoint, but just a little bit of a peek under the hood from a draft perspective. And then circling back a little bit on my arm for this week and also my arm last week, Cole Triba at a UC Santa Barbara. He had an excellent freshman year in 2024. He's dealt with a little bit of an injury issue this spring, which is, you know, he has not seen the mound as much. But last spring, 65 Ks to 14 walks across 47 innings. Undersized lefty, but he's got kind of an appealing degree of explosiveness in his delivery. Low 90s fastball, has got a ton of arm side life, and then his low to high 70s to low 80s slider will flash plus with a ton of long sweeping action. So rounds out his arsenal with a changeup that'll flash some tumble and fade, but primarily a fastball slider guy. Didn't throw last week. Ricky Ojeda also didn't throw last week, but I foresee Triba towing the rubber at least once this weekend. If not, I'm just going to have to take the L, I think.
Yeah, we before I even offer my picks, let the record show. We will be abandoning this pitching portion of picks to click if these guys don't play this week. If one of them doesn't play, the other one, if they even get into the game, I think will earn that person a point. So, yeah, again, big week here. Two potential points on the line. For my hitter to challenge Caden Bodine, I'm going with Kyle Fossum, an outfielder from Youngstown State. The back of the baseball card, Peter, as you like to say, is outstanding for Fossum so far. He's hitting .465, on base .561, slugging .889, 10 home runs, 12 doubles, 29 RBIs. We're talking about somebody here who is putting together a superstar season, and good for him, because this is a transfer portal guy who went from the University of Washington and dropped down a little bit. Very clearly, though, Peter, has found his level at Youngstown and has looked outstanding. Again, those numbers are just astounding. So that's my hitter. And then just to recap, Ricky Ojeda has been great so far this season. Lefty for UC Irvine, kind of in a do-everything role out of the bullpen. He can close. He can give him multiple innings. He's done both so far this season. In 10 appearances, none of which came last week, he has thrown 23.1 innings, has a 2.31 ERA, 34 strikeouts to 11 walks. And as we like to talk about in this podcast, definitely a guy who I would have my eye on if you like paying attention to the Team USA rosters over the summer, probably somebody who is going to be on a radar there, like a lot of the guys we talk about on this podcast. So those are the clicks to pick for this week for Peter, Cole Triba and Caden Bodine. For me, Ricky Ojeda from UC Irvine and Kyle Fossum from Youngstown State. Peter, it brings us to our final segment. As always, some final thoughts as we head into week 8. Midweek games begin really any minute here. We're recording this on Tuesday, April 1st at about 3 p.m.
Yeah, it gets a lot of attention annually, just how good the SEC is, but it's hard to not marvel at how exceptional it's been this season in particular. All five of the top five teams are from the Southeastern Conference, and eight of the top 10. And we kind of got into a discussion offline with just how good that top five tier is of Tennessee, Arkansas, Texas, Georgia, and LSU. All five, obviously, in from our perspective, are national championship contenders. And you can expand that further out to a few more teams in the conference. But just an historical season so far for the SEC. And I'm very excited to see kind of where this whole thing ends up, because we'll be talking about a lot of things that haven't happened in quite some time from a poll standpoint, potentially an Omaha standpoint, a regional berth standpoint. So just a banner year already for the SEC.
And it's certainly a highly competitive conference and some really interesting stuff happening there. I will do with my final thought the same thing I've tried to do in every episode, and that is to highlight a team that maybe we aren't talking about as much, and in this case, a player who we may not be talking about enough, and that is Hawaii quarterback Micah Alejado. I hope I'm pronouncing that right. He will be joining the baseball team, made four appearances and one start as Hawaii's quarterback last year, and I guess was kind of walking around campus with a sneaky mid-90s fastball, and went to head coach Rich Hill with the baseball team and said, hey, I have interest in being a two-sport athlete. And just to quote Rich Hill here, he has a live arm. Everyone saw what he could do on the football field. When he hit low to mid-90s consistently on his fastball during a workout, we started to consider the seriousness of what he could do to help us. This is a very good Hawaii team, too, that is certainly in contention not only to make the postseason and have the Big West probably be a two-bid league, but maybe even is in contention to win that conference, even over UC Irvine. They've been really good so far this year. And now they have a mid-90s, probably relieving left-handed pitcher who's joined their roster, who was just hanging around on campus. So I find that to be highly fascinating and maybe kind of landscape-changing in the Big West. And I find it so interesting, actually, that I'm going to allow you to touch on it real quick before we sign off here.
Yeah, it's just super cool. I mean, how many other Division I quarterbacks do you have nationally that are also on the teams that are also in their respective athletic programs, baseball team? I mean, Austin Simmons last year at Ole Miss, but he's no longer on the baseball team. He's kind of put all of his eggs into one basket with football, and especially joining the team mid season. That's kind of a one of one situation. So, I mean, I'm really excited to see Alejado toe the rubber. I mean, they said he's available starting tonight against High Point. I'd be surprised if he throws tonight against High Point, but it sounds like he'll get his first game action soon. This fastball, if it's into the mid-90s with a at least serviceable breaking ball, it's just a very exciting package. And a lot of it has to do with the fact that he's also a quarterback on the football team, but just a really cool situation all around, kind of a one-of-one situation in a number of ways. So an exciting Hawaii team and a talented Hawaii team, just improved, it sounds like, in both areas.
And one thing I'll add here that I think is interesting and worth note, if there's one thing Hawaii does particularly well under the direction of head coach Rich Hill, who's been there for quite some time, it's pitch. They are excellent on the mound. They were the best team in the country last year as measured by ERA, in pitching. This year, they've been very good. They have a couple guys who have kind of come out of the woodworks, so to speak, over the last couple of years who are now looking like really good pitchers. And like you just said, now you have a left-handed arm who apparently has a live fastball, and according to Rich Hill, a 12-6 curveball in there that he's working on. You put him in front of the pitching development that exists on the islands over there, and like you said, very interesting prospect for this team that now maybe stands to get better.
Yeah. Without a doubt. I mean, the bullpen, not to go on a separate Hawaii segment, but as you said, they can really, really pitch. Like Isaiah Magdaleno in particular has been kind of their main dude in relief and heavily relied upon. He's appeared in 11 games already, has a 1.78 ERA with 34 Ks to just two walks across 30 innings. He's one of, if not the most advanced strike thrower in the country, just from a sheer strike percentage standpoint. It's plus command and control. another guy who I feel like will, you know, he'll open eyes nationally potentially this summer. So he's another excellent arm, and that's not even talking about Liam O'Brien, who's been similarly effective in relief and a number of other arms. So they can really, really throw. They've got a number of reliable hitters as well. Just a very, very fun Hawaii team.
Well, that will officially do it for this week's episode of the College Baseball Podcast. Before we officially say goodbye, again, I would encourage all of you to go and check out our written content over at baseballamerica.com/college. That's where we're putting up our stuff every single day. We have college content at this point in the year. Power rankings for the SEC just came out today. We have the top 25 every Monday. We got some feature stories coming out this week, just to give people kind of a glimpse into the future. One of them will be about the University of Kansas, who we talked about in this episode, and just what they've been able to do as recruiters and in terms of their success this year. And we have other exciting stuff coming too. And of course, just with the excitement at this point in the season, at the halfway point, it is worth paying attention. So again, head on over to baseballamerica.com/college. But for this episode of the College Baseball Podcast, for Peter Flaherty, my name is Jacob Rudner, and we will see you next week.